Well, we are in week four of our series, Bringing People to Jesus, and this was a series that was originally supposed to be 6 weeks, and then it bumped itself to 7 weeks, and now I've settled on 8 weeks, and so we will be right up to the first Sunday of September now. But so far, if you've been following along and kind of paying attention, you've probably caught that we're building a little bit on each week as we go. The first week we talked about that really just simple invitation, that how powerful that is. Come and see. And that's really the first right step that we need to take if we're going to lead people, bring people to Jesus. It's to invite them to come along and discover what we have discovered, or better yet, what has discovered us. And we saw that the disciples didn't just use that. Jesus himself used that as he called his disciples. But that doesn't always go real smooth. We know there's, as we do that, it's a normal occurrence that we will encounter obstacles. And so a couple weeks ago, we looked at what we might call the obstacles that we would run into out there with those four friends who brought their paralyzed buddy to Jesus. They literally had to go through physical obstacles to make that happen, both human obstacles, and they literally tore the roof off of a house to get their friend to Jesus. But the importance of not letting those things stand in our way. Last week, we talked about some more obstacles. The difference, though, is that those obstacles weren't something that were out there. They were something inside of us. And so we looked at the story of Jonah and his unwillingness to go to the people of Nineveh because he had let's face it, Nineveh had earned the reputation, but he was unwilling to go to bring the message of redemption and hope that God had given him to bring to those people until he had to go through a few things. And so sometimes we have to overcome the prejudices and boundaries and things that we've set up in our own lives. This week, we're going to continue to kind of look at that and look at another obstacle that in and of itself is not necessarily wrong, but it can become an obstacle. And that's, we all have a desire, and we hit on this last week. We want the comfortable. We want the familiar. We want things to kind of operate the way that we've designed them, the way that we understand that they should operate. But sometimes, in order to bring people to Jesus, we have to adjust, we have to make room, we have to do things that aren't necessarily comfortable for us. If you think about your family traditions, particularly around the dinner table at holidays, you know that there's a certain way you expect things to go. If you're anything like my wife's family, this was something that they didn't just do on holidays. This was a weekly occurrence. Every Sunday, Steph and her brothers and her mom and dad and her cousins, they would go out to their grandparents for Sunday dinner. I mean, it was a weekly occurrence. And there was the only word I can think to describe it is there was a liturgy to how the meal went. Everybody knew where they were sitting. Everybody knew what people drank, if it was tea or lemonade or water. Everybody knew which direction the food was supposed to go and who got to go first and all of those things. But what happens in a situation like that when something or somebody new comes into the situation? I was one of those that came new into the situation. You have to adjust. I mean, you have to make space physically. You have to make space socially, because this person doesn't know the things that are going on. They don't know. Thankfully, I was very welcome into that situation. But you have to adjust. And whether it's something that we are aware of or whether we want to admit it, there's a certain tension that happens in situations like that where the familiar is disrupted, when we have to make space in our lives for things that we wouldn't otherwise normally make space for. And that tension that we experience in those situations, well, that is exactly the same tension that we see Jesus introduce over and over and over again in the Gospels. He was always inviting new people in. He was always inviting unexpected guests, and he still does that. The difference is he doesn't just do that himself. He asks us to join him in making space and in making room for those new people. And that's precisely what our story in the Gospel of Luke is about today. It's the story of the calling of Levi in Luke chapter 5. We're going to be in verses 27 through 32, and we're just going to walk through this a few verses at a time. But this is what verse 27 and 28 says. Later, as Jesus left the town, he saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at his collector's booth. "Follow me and be my disciple," Jesus said to him. So Levi got up, left everything, and followed him. Now, if we were to just stop the story right there, that it sounds, I mean, it's a pretty radical thing for a guy to get up and leave his, what he's doing, but it almost sounds like it's a story of a guy who is working a job, gets a better job offer, and decides, oh, I think I'm going to go do this now. But there's a lot more going on here than just somebody switching professions or switching what he's doing. This was an act or an event that would have sent shockwaves through the people around, especially anybody around who was familiar with Jesus and knew who Levi was. Luke tells us that Levi was a tax collector. And he was not just a tax collector, he was a Jewish tax collector working for the Roman government. Now, we have an idea of tax collectors in our minds in the IRS. We don't like them, we don't care for them, but we know they've got a job to do. That would have been a gentle description of the opinion that first century Jews would have had of tax collectors, let alone their fellow Jews who had become tax. They were the lowest of the low. They were scum. They were traitors. They had sold out their fellow Jews to enrich the Roman Empire and to build up the military empire of the Romans that was really responsible for keeping Jews second-class citizens. Worse still, the whole system was corrupt. A tax collector would go to the Roman government and they would bid to have a specific district that they could be over, which they would basically say, I can get this much in taxes for you. And if they won the bid, then they would have to give that amount that they collected to the Roman government. But they were free to charge over and above anything that they could get, and whatever they got, they could keep. And so you can imagine there were some pretty sly guys who were tax collectors in the Roman Empire. And if you've seen any of the Chosen, Levi in that story, he's pretty slick. He's very up here and knows what he's doing. And that's probably pretty much who Levi was in this story. They basically had a license from the Roman government to extort their neighbors. And they were seen as outcasts. They were outcasts socially because of that, but they were also outcasts religiously because of all of the people that they associated with and the behavior that they engaged in. So no respectable rabbi, let alone a devout Jew, would have had anything to do with a tax collector. They were outcasts. They were the ultimate outsider. And Luke tells us that Jesus saw Levi. Now, that's not an accidental word. I don't know that it was that he just saw Levi. He was looking for Levi. And he sees him there at his booth, and he walks up this place of shame, this symbol of oppression, and he doesn't see a category. He doesn't see a label. He sees a person. He doesn't see Levi the traitor, Levi the sinner. He sees a man who's created in the image of God, a man with a future, a man with the potential to be a world changer. And then Jesus speaks two of the most powerful words he says in all the Gospels: follow me. It's not a suggestion. It's not a question. There's no like, follow me. No, it's a divine summons. It is an invitation into a whole new life, a whole new identity, a new community, a new destiny. And what Jesus does here tells us a few very important things about who Jesus is. The first thing that it tells us is that Jesus sees people beyond their labels. While society, and particularly Levi's fellow Jews, while they were putting him in a box labeled sinner or traitor, and again, let's face it, those weren't necessarily wrong labels. I mean, he was a traitor to his own people. While they were busy doing that, Jesus saw what Levi could be. He saw a future disciple. He saw a future apostle, the man that we now know as Matthew, who wrote the first gospel. So he knew that there was something in Matthew that if he could just get him connected with the Father, Matthew's life would be completely different. Jesus was able to see the potential in Matthew that everybody else's prejudice had blinded them to. The second thing that we see there is that Jesus invites the unlikely. And this isn't the only time he does this. You'll look at all 12 of his disciples. They were not the religious elite. They were not. Most of them were not even the morally upright. There was a tax collector and a zealot. There were fishermen. These were not the cream of the crop type people that you would expect, which should give every single one of us a lot of hope. Because if Jesus can call people like that and use them, oh my goodness, he could use any single one of us. No one is too far gone. There's nobody whose past is so damaged that it disqualifies them from Jesus' future. But here's the third thing that we learn about Jesus, is that Jesus' call demands a response. And Levi responded. It says, Levi got up, left everything, and followed him. We don't get any sense in the story that there's any hesitation from Levi. He didn't say, you know, can you give me a 5-year plan of what this is going to look like? You know, I got a pretty cushy gig right here. Or at least, can you let me finish out this quarter? This has been a good, there's been a lot of taxes this time. Can I finish this up? No, he leaves everything. He leaves his tax booth. He leaves his money bags. He leaves the financial security that his job has given him. He leaves his entire identity behind. That's the power of an invitation from Jesus. And the thing about it is, one of the things that was so compelling, not just to Levi, but to everybody else that responded to Jesus' call, is they knew that Jesus doesn't just tolerate us. He invites us. He looks for us. He is seeking us out. He actively pursued the outsiders. And as his followers, that is exactly the same thing that we are called to do. In our ministry of bringing people to Jesus, one of the things that we have to do is adopt his gaze, which means that we have to start seeing people the way that Jesus sees them. If we only look at people the way that we see them, we're going to find everything we can wrong with them. I think even the most positive and encouraging people, there's just something in us that wants to find the flaws in other people. But if we look at them the way that Jesus looks at them, yes, those flaws are going to be there, but we're going to see beyond. We're going to see what Jesus can see, like he sees in Levi. I can see what can happen with this person. But this story doesn't end with just Levi's response, his personal decision. In fact, the whole thing's just getting started. This is what we read in verse 29. Later, Levi held a banquet in his home with Jesus as the guest of honor. Many of Levi's fellow tax collectors and other guests also ate with them. Like that second classification, other guests, is funny because it's a gentle way of identifying the other. They were other sinners. They were other outcasts. Because let's face it, those are the only type of people that Levi was probably allowed to hang out with. And I love I love what he does. The very first thing that Luke tells us that he does in respond is he throws a party. He invites his people. He invites his fellow tax collectors and other guests. And again, those other guests were probably, they were the rejects of society, people that the religious folks wouldn't touch, they didn't want to have anything to do with. They were Levi's friends. This was his community, which is a natural response to something dramatic and exciting happening in your life. You want to tell the people who are closest to you. You want to invite them in to experience the same thing. In this case, Levi's life is completely changed by the grace of Jesus. He wants all of these other people to know this can be yours too. He immediately creates space for everyone he knew to meet the one who had just changed his life forever. But again, just like we saw a couple of weeks ago, not everybody's excited about what's going on in this house. The scene was about to be interrupted. And this is what we read in verse 30. But the Pharisees and their teachers of religious law complained bitterly to Jesus' disciples. Why do you eat and drink with such scum? I imagine the Pharisees weren't anywhere near the house. They were watching from a distance. But they knew exactly what was going on. And they're horrified by what they see. Now, to understand where their outrage is coming from, we have to understand, and we've talked about this, so this is nothing new, the whole act of table fellowship and sharing meals with people, especially opening up your home for like a party, that was a radical act. It was more than just sitting down and sharing food. You were identifying on some level with the people that you were welcoming at your table. It was an act of intimacy, of identification. When you ate, who you ate with said a lot about who you were and who you were identifying yourself with. And here's Jesus, this popular new rabbi, not just talking to these sinners, he's actually having a meal with them. He's actually on some level identifying with them. He's offering them his friendship. And it's interesting, you see the number of times that Jesus is at a meal that's not at his own place, that he ends up really being the host of the meal. I mean, he's welcomed into Matthew's house, and Jesus becomes the center of, he becomes the one who's he's the guest, but he's also the host. And this drives the Pharisees nuts. From their perspective, this was not just scandalous. This was beyond the pale. It was beyond compromising. It was a complete violation of everything they understood holiness to be. The Pharisees had a very developed and very clear theology of holiness that included a very clear theology of separation. To be holy was to be separate from anything or anyone they deemed to be unclean. And they had very strict rules and categories and boundaries that protected their holiness and protected their purity. The problem was the boundaries and the rules and everything that they set up tended to keep the people who needed God the most on the outside. But Jesus didn't do that. He didn't build walls. He didn't build barriers. He built bridges. His instinct, the way he always moved toward people and not away from them. He didn't look at sinners and see a threat to his reputation or his own purity. He saw hurting people who needed a savior. He didn't hand them a list of rules. Now, he did call them to a certain kind of lifestyle. But the invitation was to join him. He didn't give them a list of rules and say, you go get all this figured out, and then when you've got this all taken care of, you can come back and we'll talk. No, he invited them into his life. His holiness wasn't this fragile thing that needed to be protected under glass. It was strong. It was rugged. It was a healing love that was meant to be given away. The Pharisees were like doctors who were afraid to go into the hospital because of the germs. What good is being a doctor? Jesus is like one of those old country doctors that made house calls and didn't care the situation that he stepped into. Which leads us to this whole kind of situation and how it's developed leads us to this realization for us. Levi opens his house in hospitality. Jesus becomes this one who welcomes all of them in and brings them all under his wing. It tells us that hospitality is a kingdom strategy. We can see Levi kind of following the example that Jesus has set. He didn't preach a sermon to his friends, although there were things that they needed to learn. He threw a dinner party. He used what he had. He had his home. He had food. He had some resources to create this environment that was at least non-threatening enough for these people to feel like they were welcome to come into so that they could have an encounter with Jesus. The whole reason Levi throws the party is not so that he can celebrate himself. He wants to celebrate and invite his friends to meet Jesus. And I wonder, what if we started to see the whole process of evangelism as less of a formal presentation? You know, we know the four spiritual laws and those types of things, and those are wonderful, those are valuable, but that's only a part of evangelism. What if we saw it more as less as a formal presentation and more of a shared meal? What if bringing people to Jesus was less about getting them in the church? And I will tell you, as a pastor, I love getting people in the church. But again, that's only part of the journey. It's an important part, but it's only part of the journey. And in our culture and in our society now, it's usually something that happens farther down the road than it used to. Again, as evangelism's not harder, it's just longer. It used to be you would invite somebody to church, they would get saved. Now people are getting saved, and it might take months to get them to come to church. I know that's backwards. We don't like how that works. But what if it's about making space at our tables to create a situation and an environment where people can encounter Jesus for themselves? If Jesus was willing to sit and eat with people whose lives were a mess, then we as his followers, we have to be willing to make room in our own lives and at our own tables for the people around us who need to experience the grace of God. And when the Pharisees voice their complaint about this, it's not just, they're not just whispering under their breath. They complain directly to the disciples. They're making this a very public kind of confrontation here. It was a challenge. And Jesus, overhearing what they have to say, he responds directly. And he gives one of the clearest mission statements, probably maybe outside of the Great Commission, that he gives in all the Gospels. It is the theological anchor of this entire story. It says, Jesus answered them, "Healthy people don't need a doctor. Sick people do. I have come to call not those who think they are righteous, but those who know they are sinners and need to repent." So Jesus reframes the entire mission of God for the Pharisees, and by extension, the mission of God's people. He's saying that there are really two kinds of people in the world. There are those who know they're sick, and those who pretend they are healthy. Which really, when you think about it, is one kind of people. There's just a bunch of sick people. Just some are willing to admit it, and some think that they're healthy. The Pharisees saw themselves as the healthy ones. And they had earned that reputation. I mean, they had it all together. They followed the rules. They were morally upright. They were better morally in following the rules than I would bet most of us in this room are. They were the spiritual elite, but they didn't think they had any need for a doctor. And because of that, the great physician couldn't do anything for them. Their self-righteousness was a terminal condition that they couldn't have anything done about because it prevented them from seeking the only cure that was available to them. Then there are the rest of everybody, the sick, the tax collectors and the sinners. They knew they were broken. They knew they were outcasts. Their sin was public. It was out front. I mean, it was front and center. They had no illusions about their own goodness. But because they knew they were sick, even though many of them felt trapped in their sickness, because they knew they were sick, they were open to the doctor. They were open. They were ready for the cure that Jesus had for them. And Jesus' words to the Pharisees are a direct challenge to any form of religious pride. He's basically saying, if you think you're good enough on your own, if you think you don't need saving, I can't help you. But if you know you're broken, if you know you're a sinner, if you are acutely aware of your need of grace, you are precisely the person I came for. That's why he was looking for Levi. That is the heart of the gospel. And it leads us to a very important conclusion about our identity in the church, something that I think we really need to think long and hard about how much we look like this. The church is more of a hospital for sinners than it is a museum for saints. I'm all about celebrating saints. I love that. I love celebrating the people who have gone before us but really, if we're honest about it, the church was established to be an outpost of healing and hope for the broken. It takes saints to do that. But here's the difference. Think about the difference between a museum and a hospital. A museum is a place where you display, if they've been well preserved and well taken care of, pristine, perfect artifacts. You put them behind a velvet rope. You speak in hushed tones. You admire everything from a distance, and the motto is, look, but don't touch. It's clean, it's orderly, it's quiet, it's respectable, but let's be honest, it's for things that are dead. They might have once been alive, but it's for things that are no longer alive. A hospital, on the other hand, is messy. It's noisy, especially those who specialize in trauma care and crisis response. I have a nurse nodding her head over here. Yeah, you know. It's chaotic. People who come in there, they're broken, they're bleeding, they're sick, they're in pain. There's a sense of urgency that something needs to be done. It's usually not very pretty, but it's a place of healing, it's a place of hope, and it's a place where sick people get well. And even though people die in hospitals, as opposed to a museum, it is a place that is teeming with life. And I think too often, maybe unconsciously we do this, we would rather our churches be museums than hospitals. We want them to be neat, orderly, respectable, full of people who look and act and sound just like us. And we can run the risk of becoming more concerned with our own comfort, more concerned with protecting our own status like the Pharisees, than reaching the lost. We guard the velvet ropes as opposed to Jesus kind of opening the door and saying, whosoever will can come. So my question is, does our church feel more like a museum or a hospital? Are we more concerned with our reputation or with our mission? Are we willing to create space in our lives and in this building for people who don't have it all together?
That's funny that I say that, because there's not a single one of us that has it all together.
So whether you like to admit it or not, we've already been creating space for people who don't have it all together. Our answer to that question will determine much of the church that we will be. So how do we move, or how do we avoid becoming a museum and move more toward becoming a hospital? How do we live out this radical grace of Jesus in Canton, Illinois in 2025? Because again, we don't have tax collectors like they had in the first century, but we have those categories. Well, here are three next right steps. Get used to that phrase, because it's going to close a lot of my sermons coming up. Next, I'm going to use it more. Next right steps. Here's three next right steps we can take this week. First, open your life. If we are going to pour grace on other people, it's going to require proximity to people. We can't throw grace from a distance and then run away. Throwing water balloons at people and then running away. No, we have to be proximate to people who need grace. We can't show the love of Jesus to people we never interact with. We all know people outside of the walls of this church. How intentional are we about building genuine relationships with our neighbor? And this is something we've talked about over and over and over again. With our neighbors, with our coworkers, and the people that we meet in our community. And even though we have a goal for them to meet Jesus, don't go to them with an agenda to convert them. Then they become a project. Again, another label. We want to do everything that we can so that they can have an encounter with Jesus. You can't change them. Jesus can. But many times, in order for them to meet him, they have to be in proximity to somebody who knows him. Connect your life with others. Share meals. Listen to their stories. Listen to their stories. Don't try to solve their problems while they're in the middle of sharing them with you. I'm a fixer. I might not say it out loud, but I'm working the solution in my head. Listen to them, their hopes, their hurts. Let them see what a life lived with Jesus, a life filled with grace, looks like up close. Up close, that's scary. Second, invite and include. Who is your Levi? Who is the person that you need to be looking for? Who is the person in your life, at work, in your family, in your neighborhood, who doesn't just feel like an outsider? You're pretty sure that's them. Who is it that needs to experience the radical acceptance of Jesus? Once you have that person, your mission is simple. Invite them and include them. Throw your own Levi party. Hey, come celebrate with the rest of us outcasts. It doesn't have to be fancy. The goal is to move someone from the category of stranger to friend. Invite them into your life, not just to a church service. Although, again, we would love to have them here. But maybe that's not the next right step. Maybe the next right step is to just connect. Relationship is the bridge that grace walks across. I wish I knew who I could give credit to that for. I didn't write that, but that's in my sermon. Third, and this might have qualified as being the most important in the first, check your heart. We might not be able to do the other two things until we do this. Our actions flow from our hearts, so honestly ask yourself, do I have a Pharisee's perspective on other people? Or do I have Jesus' heart? When I see someone who's different, who's messy, who's struggling, is my first reaction one of judgment and to run away? Or is it compassion and curiosity? That's the thing that I don't think we appreciate enough, the curiosity of Jesus. Not that he didn't already know what was going on, but he asked a lot of questions, usually in response to a question that he got. Are we drawn into toward those people, or are we pushed away? Pray that God would reveal the things in your life that are barriers, much like the story of Jonah last week, and ask him to do some spiritual surgery if necessary. You might need a heart transplant and a daily infusion of God's grace that reminds us that we are all just beggars telling other beggars where to find bread. We are all the sick who have been found by the great physician. I heard about a church that did something that was very simple and yet ended up being very profound. In their sanctuary, they always left one specific seat empty. And the reason they did that, it wasn't for show. It wasn't for decoration. It was a tangible symbol. It was a reminder to the entire congregation that there was always room for one more. That there was always space for somebody else. It was their way of asking, who is not yet here? Who needs to fill this seat? And if it wasn't that specific seat, it was, who in my life needs to fill my empty seat? That's a very common practice of small groups, the concept of the empty chair. What if we lived like that? What if our church became known as a place with an empty chair mentality? If every time we gather for worship or for a small group or for a meal, our first thought is, who's missing that should be here? Who can I invite? Who needs to sit at this table and meet Jesus? Because that story of Luke 5, it's not over. It's still being written 2,000 years later. Jesus is still walking through our world. He's still seeking out the unlikely. He's still calling the Levites. He's still sitting at tables, sharing meals, and offering space to people who feel far from God or anyone else of significance. He's still making room. And the question left for us to answer is, are we? Let's be a church that makes room.